our panel this morning, economist Colm McCarthy, Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent with the Irish Times, Nora Owen, former Fine Gael Minister for Justice, Gráinne Healy, public affairs consultant, and Ian Guider, markets editor with the Sunday Business Post. You're all very welcome, guys.
Thanks, Brendan. Good
morning, Brendan.
We probably should start with the story that is convulsing the nation, maybe not here in Dublin 4, but certainly out there beyond the pale, and that is the beef deal. Suzanne Lynch, you were looking at that. It's the front page of the Sunday
front
Times.
Front story of the Sunday Times. I think this is a very big story for Ireland at the moment, and it kind of slipped in at the end of the week of a busy news week, but very significant. The EU, after 20 years of negotiations, has finally signed off on a deal with the Mercosur countries. That's a group of South American countries. Now, they're going to be given greater access to EU markets with beef, but in exchange, the EU countries will be able to sell other things into the South American.
A lot of cars, I believe.
Cars, pharmaceuticals, industrial products. But I think this is the Sunday Times article. According to the Sunday Times article, I think there's questions at the very least for the Irish Commissioner, Phil Hogan. He's been the Agriculture Commissioner now for 5 years. He's coming to the end of that term. And if this is his legacy, I think there will be questions for him. They're saying here in this piece that Hogan's prospects of being nominated by the Taoiseach for a second term as Commissioner may be damaged by this.
Yeah, no, now, in fairness, I think Micheál Martin is kind of making those noises.
So Phil Hogan was out yesterday on this and he described it as a fair and balanced deal. But I think there was disappointment from the Irish side that the quotas were...
Well, Hogan is making the point that there is give and take involved in these things.
But for Ireland, Ireland won't benefit much from the exports to South America. That's just the way it is. It'll be more affected negatively by this deal. But this is the issue with the EU. Once we nominate a commissioner, you know, their job then is to work for the European Union as a whole, for the greater good of the EU, not for an individual country.
Did we always suspect a bit that Phil Hogan was not working for the EU as a whole and that he was out there working for us? Is that what it was, Noron?
I mean, they always say that when you're appointed as a commissioner, you're meant to take off the home jersey. Yeah. But the truth of it is, you're still an Irish person and you still have, you come back and forth and you still have your friends who are in politics and in business in Ireland. So you're keeping an eye out for them.
Phil Hogan is quite involved in politics back here, isn't he?
Well, not anymore. No, I don't think so. I don't know. He may be having quiet meetings with, but he's not in any way involved.
He was always quite involved back here.
And I think he's been quite a link and a very positive force in the Brexit negotiations. But I think Jody Corkin's piece in the Sunday Independent is interesting on this. He is talking about this trade pact, and it makes a very important point, I think, that, you know, I think it raises questions about the strength of, you know, Ireland's role within the EU and how much leverage we have, really, when it comes to big decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, we're under pressure on corporate tax, and obviously there's a lot of solidarity at the moment with the border, but Jody Corker makes a point. He says, and I'm quoting him now, he asks whether the Taoiseach has used up all his political capital in Europe on the backstop. And I think this is a theme that's coming up in a few of the articles here today. Owen Harris makes a similar point, saying, you know, has it been a bit of a gamble, essentially, backing the backstop and not maybe being prepared to compromise on this? I think this is coming up now as a sense that this might be where the conversation on Brexit is going, because we're reaching this kind of stalemate in October. But anyway, I think the trade deal is something that's come out of left field. Farmers now, Phil Hogan would argue that, as you say, it's give and take. It's a small drop in the ocean.
And he also
in terms
said,
of
I think, yesterday
beef
that
market.
He says we've secured. I want to be fair to Phil Hogan here. Mm-hmm. We've secured for the first time in a free trade agreement $1 billion in financial support and common market organisation support in the event of a market disturbance when it's implemented. So he seems to be suggesting there.
But that's funds from the European Commission that would give to farmers in difficulty.
That would get some help.
But that would be short-term. If this becomes a long-term change in market. Now, I mean, the other argument is that it is a small percentage in terms of the overall beef market. But I suppose for farmers, at a point where they're facing serious challenges with Brexit, I think this is unfortunate timing, essentially.
Colin McCarthy.
Yeah. I think the initial reaction, though, may turn out to have been a little bit overplayed, Brendan. There is an arrangement currently with particularly Brazil and Argentina. This Mercosur group is Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay and Uruguay. Mm-hmm. And those countries and a couple of others, Bolivia, which is not part of Mercosur, in South America, are substantial beef producers, and they have an extensive style of beef production there, which is low cost. And farmers in those countries who sell beef get about half what you get in Europe for selling beef, because it's more expensive to produce beef in this part of the world, and arguably is produced to a higher standard, veterinary and yeah. welfare standards.
They use hormones and things,
And all that sort of stuff. However, you've got to have a bit of perspective about this. All of the countries outside Europe, and this goes for South America, but it goes for other parts of the world too, if they come to do new trade deals with the European Union, they are interested in agricultural exports because they have agricultural stuff to export, and Europe is a big market for food imports, as everybody knows. And it has a relatively protected agricultural sector. So it's not a surprise that the South Americans said we'd like to sell more beef in Europe as part of this new trade deal. The amount... it's not that big. It's 99,000 tons. It is just over. That is just over 1% of the European beef market, and it's going to come in not at a zero tariff, but at a low tariff. It's complicated, but there are preferential tariffs. You get a quota at a certain preferential tariff, and then the rest of it is at a full tariff. And the Europeans actually initially offered slightly more than 99,000 tons, and there's a haggle about. What can we export to you? I don't think we're going to be selling a lot of soccer players to Brazil somehow. There must be something we can sell. But it's a haggle, and this is what's come out the other end. Now, as the government people did point out in the Sunday Times article, and they're quoted, it'll take 2 years to wrap up this deal, number one, and then it's phased in over another 5 or 6 years. So nothing bad's going to happen tomorrow to the Irish beef industry. Some very bad things could happen sooner. One of them is called Brexit, and it is on a bad
and,
scenario.
And we will, of course, come to Brexit.
The trouble for
On a bad scenario, we could have inhibitions on Irish beef exports to Britain next November. Any worries arise from this EU deal?
Colm, I was just going to say, look, you are right. Brexit is going to really hurt the beef industry, but they have struggled to find new markets. It is only in the last year or so that Irish beef is on sale in China. So anything that damages the beef industry, because they are so reliant on the British market right now, so beef coming in from Brazil or from Argentina will hurt the beef processors because they just cannot find right now other places to sell Irish beef, and we're already oversupplying the European market.
Yeah, and I think if I stand to be correct on this, but I think the tons we export to Britain is 270,000 tons. So there's 99,000 tons coming in of new South American
beef.
Of EU, yeah, but we're huge beef producers, relatively speaking. In the like some countries don't produce beef, so you know we are more exposed, relatively speaking, than most countries on this because of our high exports when it comes to beef, not just beef.
But there is a big political issue here because Michael Creed is reported. I think I saw it yesterday. Saying he's very unhappy with it. Does that mean Ireland is going to use a negative vote, and does it leave us out on the side? I mean, there's no doubt.
Yeah, I think we're in a
predicament now with Brexit and all the support we've had from the EU countries. And remember, the idea of trade deals with people bringing in their beef and that go way back. I remember visiting Namibia under my heading as a development aid person, and you know, they were looking to bring beef into getting a small quota into Europe as well. It didn't cause great fuss. I'm surprised that this has come as a shock if the discussions have been going on for 20 years, that the farming organisations weren't aware that this was coming down the road and were... I think it's the combination of the Brexit, this, the Mercosur, the whole
people
thing.
Are just have the jitters
and
anyway
I think
at the moment.
The selling of it by the EU, their PR was disastrous because the only thing I heard was the 99,000 tons of beef that was going to flood into the markets. It turns out it probably won't be into Ireland anyway. But like the rest, the upside of it, the extra pharmaceutical products, the food products that will now can be sold over into the four countries that Colm has mentioned, that is only emerging as you read, and most people don't read deep into the story.
And I
can see why farmers are objecting.
And I think, am I right in saying there is a pattern here of Europe trying to lessen its dependence on America for trade and looking to other blocs? And that actually, am I right in saying, Colm, Europe is now going to be the biggest trade partner of South America, or is practically already?
Yeah, well, Europe's trade with South America is not enormous, But it's significant, and it will grow under this deal, and this deal has been hatching for a long time. The countries that are part of it, particularly Brazil and Argentina, are big countries. I mean, the Mercosur is a big slice of the South American economy. But what's going to come in under this deal is 1% of the European market. I mean, we have to be clear.
Ronnie Healy.
One of the things that struck me about is that this is 20 years, as you've mentioned, in the making. So this idea that Boris keeps telling us that he's going to be able to do these new trade deals and he'll have the UK up and running in 6 months. I mean, the truth is these things take years, sometimes decades. And this one, I agree with Nora, I think the way it has been marketed, it's a front page of the paper, it's like shock, as if it was only thought about yesterday. This is a long time in coming, and maybe some of the gains, we need to look at what is the give and take for Ireland.
Just one specific thing on that, you were mentioning about the US, like is the EU looking for bigger markets? I think an important context here to keep in mind is that the EU and US trade talks have really stopped under Trump. And in particular, there's real fears in Brussels that Trump he's threatened to impose tariffs on cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Germany sells a lot of cars into America. So this is obviously giving Germany and other car-producing countries a market in South America. I think that's a very important context to why this has been signed in this way at this point.
And we don't make any cars anymore in Ireland.
No, not
make parts or anything. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it will be a political difficulty now.
Yeah, I was going to ask
Mike
you.
Jody Cochran makes
the point that having already kind of lost ground in urban areas, that this is going to damage Fine Gael rurally as well, is it?
Well, anything that touches on farmers' lives, and I mean, we know the number of people farming full-time is reducing every year, and more people have to have off-farm incomes as well in order to even continue doing the farming that they're doing. It won't be an easy one, and if there's an election in the next 12 months, which there inevitably will be, and my money is on sooner than 12 months, it will be an issue, there's no doubt about it. And then on top of that, the broadband and all the other things that are moving around. I don't know what Michael Creed can do with the other ministers or the other agricultural ministers, whether he can actually vote against it, and does it kill the deal? I haven't had a chance to look at whether Ireland can use a veto.
If it's a trade deal, you can't. If it's categorised as a political deal, you can't. So all he can do is to
make noises. But as Colm says, it may well be that the story isn't as major a damage to the farmers as they first think. They've had a bad time with their beef, and over the summer, over the last few months, there have been talks about the beef farming in Ireland. So this is new. And also we ban beef with hormones, and Brazil, I know, was always using hormones. Whether they've stopped using it or will stop now because of this new trade deal, I'm not sure.
Ian Guider, Nora mentioned the broadband there, and the Sunday Business Post, your paper, has this front page story. Could you first endeavour to explain this story to us in broad terms?
To wrap up the national broadband plan of 8 years
what are AIR offering to do here?
Yeah, this was a wonderful bombshell dropped by Carol Ann Lennon, the chief executive of AIR, at the Oireachtas committee during the week. So AIR were one of the consortium that were looking to be part of the national broadband plan. They pulled out about 18 months ago. And during the week at the committee, she dropped in, well, actually, instead of spending the guts of $3 billion with Granahan McCourt, we can do this for £1 billion, and the state saves €2 billion. Now, the government are pushing back on this and saying, look, what AIR are proposing will not be the full bells and whistles program that the National Broadband Plan will do, that it will leave the fibre pipe that you will get your super fast broadband at the end of the road, at the end of the boring, it won't go right into the door. So the government are pushing back and saying you could have, if they were to go ahead with the AIR proposal, 81,000 homes that would have to pay a lot of money to get connected. AIR, we're reporting.
Which some people might say, well, look, you make your choices, you pay your money. If you want to live out in the middle of nowhere, or you live there and you want broadband right up to the door, maybe you need to pay a little bit extra for it.
Yep, and AIR are pointing out, look, it won't actually be that figure. My colleague Peter O'Dwyer is saying the figure could be as low as 8,000, because AIR are saying, look, some people will have to pay more. It may only be a small fixed charge to get connected.
And without getting too technical, they say what they did in the rollout that AIR has done already, of it, is it 400,000? 300,000. 300,000. 300,000. that they did build new poles so that that would bring
and
down
no
that number
no extra
a lot.
Cost whatsoever to the people who signed up for it. Now, the trouble for the government here is you would say on the face of it, let's just rip up the contract with Granaghan McCourt and hug air as close as possible to get this deal. There does seem to be a suggestion from, particularly from the government side, that they're not convinced that air's plan gives everybody broadband, and also suggesting it'll cost more money. And you also have to remember here, AIR have taken out a hell of a lot of customers from what potentially would have been the national broadband plan over the last number of years. They have found suddenly that some people are commercially viable. AIR are in the business of making money. Let's not forget that. They want to make a profit out of this. So will they cherry pick the best of them, and we will still have some people, as you said, that will have to pay a little bit more or won't be able to get it at all?
Colin McCarthy, there's a suggestion in the inside piece about it that if the air service was good enough for the 300,000 people who've got it already, is it not good enough for everybody else as well?
Well, the 300,000 people have been passed by this extension of air's network. My understanding is only about 15 or 20% of them have signed up. So there wouldn't be 300,000.
Were they? Did those figures hold up, though? Or was there some dispute about that, those figures, I think?
There always is. The issue here really is whether the government embarked, and this would be 7 or 8 years ago now, Ian, on this national broadband plan in an organised fashion. Did somebody somewhere deep in the bowels of the Department of Communications sit back and say, right, we don't have great broadband coverage in Ireland, in parts of urban Ireland, as well as in rural Ireland. Can we work out a plan to improve this in some feasible way without spending too much money? This is the way governments are meant to go about planning the public capital programme. And it's blatantly clear to me that nobody did do that.
Hang on a minute. Did they not come up with this big, complicated procurement process and go about it in a very methodical fashion?
That is precisely what they did. And that's precisely the point I was trying to make. What they didn't do was sit back and ask, for example, how did we bring electricity wires to every single house and building in Ireland? Which we did a long time ago. And we're continuing to do. And we didn't do that by dictating the technology from the civil service. We didn't do it in this elaborate procurement sort of way. And we didn't do it for free. If you live in a remote spot up a mountain down in rural Ireland and you are not plugged into the electricity grid, if you ring up the ESB, they'll quote you a figure.
Yeah,
it's always been like that.
Euro yard or a meter.
And if you live on the edge of a town, say you live 500 metres from the extremity of the town water and sewage system, if you ring up the county council and say, I'd like to have pipe water up to my, they'll say, certainly, we'll send you an estimate. Mm-hmm. So none of these things were considered properly at the beginning.
It sounds are you leaning towards the air plan then?
I don't have a 3-point plan. I just want to make this point. Every time there is a really big cock-up in the Irish public capital programme, and there have been lots of them, the National Children's Hospital was another one, there doesn't seem to be a threshold above which the government says we really should have a detailed inquiry going back to the beginning in this case. And yeah, I think we should. I think there should be a judge-led public sworn inquiry into both the broadband plan.
And would you put everything off till then?
And the National Children's Hospital. Going back to how were these projects conceived in the first instance, name names, who did what, who made what decision, who was the minister. There's been a string of ministers in both cases. How did we end up a couple of billion offside in each of them? This is too big, and that there really needs to be a process of learning.
Do we really need more inquiries that cost us millions and go on for years and years? Should we not
learn. We can learn. I mean, I was quite impressed. I was watching Caroline Lennon making this presentation. I thought, why now? And I wondered why. Now, I know AIR was in the middle of being bought over by a French company and all that was going on in the background, so maybe their eye was off the ball. But, like, this Granahan McCourt thing was announced during the local elections, that it had been, Richard Bruton said, we've been ready to do this for months and months. And I wonder why this bit of AIR's information was not being looked at, or why weren't
AIR
they
asked? AIR did say that they tried to contact the department numerous times, I think, and that no one ever got back to them.
Well, they'd already dropped out of being one of the five contributors.
They had structures that were in place around it, which they're now saying we could do it without a lot of some of those structures.
The reason why they can bring the price down is because they own the poles, so that's about 900 million or nearly a billion of the cost that ran, and they don't have to charge themselves, which seems like a very logical and
it does, but I gather there might be issues around that in terms of
competition.
But also the Taoiseach has said at first he thought it sounded a bit mad on something, and now he said, well, maybe we have to look at it again. But the problem is now that it pushes all this off. What are the contractual, now there's no contract signed,
no contract.
But I would imagine there'll be the word suing coming in somewhere or other if something happens and changes now.
We've become obsessed with delivering the national broadband plan in this current form, that everybody should have the fibre wire going to the door. There are other solutions that will give 5G, people 5G networks, you will have various, you can have satellite, there are solutions out there that will deliver you a national broadband service, but we've become obsessed with this plan that there should be an outside company and an outside bidder that will give you everything, and that everybody should have the same speed, the same price, whereas you could have a national broadband service delivered in a different way, probably cheaper than 3 billion quid.
But the good news is that government does seem to have some wriggle room on this, as Nora was saying there. Okay, we don't want to delay it forever, but it's not gone so far down the process that they can't open
although
this conversation.
Although they've spent about 25 million on the
But as Colin's saying, we're not to the point yet.
A drop in the ocean,
But, you know, this is a kind of a positive conversation that the public is able to have, I think, at this point, rather than the thing already started and there's no way back. That there is still room for both sides to be. There's been a lot of good coverage over the last few days about, well, look, it's not as simple as this, etc. Like, for example, the state aid rules on, again, the EU would have a role here in determining.
But this is going to be in the context of the forthcoming general election, which is definitely coming down, this is going to be a huge issue. People who don't have this can't work from home, they can't take calls, they're going out up the side of the house, up down the road to try and get a signal on their phones. So the idea of not having access to broadband is huge, and it will be, if this falls through now, I would hate to be the politicians knocking on the doors outside of Dublin and saying, well, actually, Colin's suggestion, we're going to have a tribe, we're going to have an investigation into this.
So you think just go with the plan we have now?
I think investigate what AIR are suggesting and see what you can come up with in terms of savings, but it has to be delivered.
Colin, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, you see, the temptation always is to say, sure, what's 2 billion quid or what's a billion on the national, you know, sure, sign the cheque and God is good.
And let's get on with it.
We're off to the elections. And so on. The cock-ups just this year have been so big that it's a wake-up call to anybody. Mm. We have a great big national development plan, great big public capital program, heading for 7 billion per annum to be spent on all sorts of different kinds of infrastructure. There is no chance of a rational, careful program of public investment here in the years ahead unless the errors that have arisen in these two cases are fully documented, names are named, and the lessons are drawn to avoid a repetition. Mm. We've been screwing up things in the public capital programme, Brendan, since I was a kid. There have been shocking cost overruns, huge mistakes made, and some things done very well.
Is there not a tendency for large public capital projects all over the world to go wildly over budget and wildly beyond delivery?
We don't run
the
world.
We're not unique, are we?
We don't run the world, we just run this place. And it is feasible to learn the lessons from these two fiascos.
I mean, one of the things that always struck me, even when I was in active politics, was Controller and Auditor General's report every year was a frightening bit of information, because he would come out with all the overruns, the wrong estimation. But in fairness, something Colm said, these cock-ups in the overspending didn't just happen this year. He said we've had a lot this year. They go right back, I mean, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. And I'm not trying to push it back into another government, but the truth of it is that some of these projects started their life. And the broadband one is in our mind. And unfortunately, the local elections, I'm afraid, I think, brought the announcement to the fore probably a bit more speedily than they were ready to do. Because if they had waited and AIR was getting themselves sorted to say all this, now the combination, I think Grainne's right, you try to see between the two things that you have on the table, you have Granahan and you have AIR, and you try to see if there's some way in which they can be either married together or one can give a better service than another. I mean, I was saying
when you say that the controller and auditor general's report and looking back on your own time in politics and everything, is the whole way a government is set up and the way it operates and everything, is it basically set up to waste money and for things to be inefficient?
Well, I don't think anybody sets out to waste money.
Is it the nature of it that this is what happens?
I don't know why it is that if you're starting a project and you have your plan and you set it in front of somebody and say, now, how much is this going to cost me? You build in a little bit of a leeway and a bit of in case something happens that you weren't expecting, that you dig down in a roadway and find oil or something. I don't know, but something, you build that in. But it is frightening how much overruns happen in even the simplest of projects.
Are politicians fit to oversee these kinds
of
things?
Well, mostly they aren't economists. They're not trained in it. But I mean, you have a full civil service there keeping an eye on these things. And it used to frighten me that the controller would come in. I was never on the Public Accounts Committee. They'd give their report, and then it would die away. And then I wondered, well, behind the scenes was some civil servant or somebody called in and said, well, why did that overrun by 1 million or 2 million or 5 million? You can bring projects in on time if it's properly planned. And I think Colm is right in degree, but I shudder to think if you go back now to do a whole review of all this again. I mean, we keep saying, let's learn by what's happened here. The hospital is a real way of learning, because they just started completely wrong on it. They didn't have the full scope of what was going to be involved in a children's hospital. And so it just kept going from 500 to 600 to 900 up to the billions now. That we've nearly lost faith or trust in using the word billions. I mean, you mentioned 25 million. 25 million is like just going down to the shops nearly now. But I mean, it isn't. It's not a funny thing. These are serious amounts of money. And I worry now for Pascal Donoghue, who has a budget to do both before and after Brexit, whichever way it turns out. And Pascal Donoghue is a very prudent man. I dealt with him in opposition when he was our spokesman. And if you went to him with some idea saying, you know, these people are looking for money, he was very careful, even in opposition, to say, no, that's they're not their right. They're not getting that. He was very prudent. And I'd say he's hurting at the moment from the kind of indication that he's not a prudent man with our finances.
Okay. Someone else who says he's hurting at the moment in Fine Gael is John Deasy. Oh. Suzanne, you were looking at, there's an interview with him in the Sunday Independent, and then there's also that story in the Mail on Sunday. So do you want to tell us about his interview in the Sunday Independent?
Well, there's been quite a bit of coverage on this, and he has sat down with a couple of journalists for the Sunday papers. And in the Sunday Independent, he speaks at length about the issues in Fine Gael as he sees them in Waterford, and also his role in the United States. Now, I would have met John Deasy on quite a few occasions in the US and based in Washington, and he's been doing a lot of work on this issue of the immigrant visa. Ireland is trying to get access to the E3 visa that's currently only open to Australian citizens, and he has been part of this push to really get this on the agenda. And he, you know, they got very far just before Christmas. It got through the House. It was stopped at the Senate because one senator opposed this.
So and Trump is going to sort that out, he promised.
As he told us. This senator, Tom Cotton, is still there. So the big question is, how are they going to win him over? Because it's one vote can sink this. So obviously, you know, one would think that this will be a background deal, if you like, between the Trump administration and Cotton, that if Tom Cotton supports this, he'd be, I presume, given something else. That's the way these things work. But John Deasy is doing that in the US, and he said in Sunday Independent he's doing that from here, a lot of work from here on this as well, including, you know, meeting US officials who come over to Ireland. He talks about playing golf during I think the summer with Mick Mulvaney, Trump's chief of staff. Now, of course, there also is an embassy, the Irish embassy. We do have an embassy in the United States as well, who's also working the contacts as well.
Yeah.
But look, there is, I suppose, a dichotomy or dilemma here between, you know, your role as a TD and your role when you have an, when you have a more outwardly facing role, like the US envoy, a very specific kind of job here. And I think that's encapsulating those tensions that have been throughout history, really, you know, how much... do you spend in your constituency? How much not?
And we do tend to say that we don't want parish pump politics, and that we don't want people clientelism to politics to be all about clientelism and all that kind of stuff. But you do have to look after the home patch. Grainne, what do you make of all of this?
I do think that in some sense, you know, if his the request from the Taoiseach was that he would take on this role, which although, you know, obviously his child goes to school, he lives in the local area, but his focus is firmly across the sea on this piece of work. So I can see how, you know, the local party grouping might think this fellow's looking in the other direction, he's not really pulling his weight in the local party framework. And there is a history. I mean, I think his own quote about, you know, when you win a seat, you inherit half your father's friends and 100% of his enemies. There is a history behind this. But on a kind of a more global note about this particular case and the other cases that are in the paper today around allegations of bullying and things, you know, this is something that has happened in a number of other political parties, that allegations are made about abuses of power, bullying happening at a very local level. And I think this is something that the all of the political parties, in this case we're talking about Fine Gael, they need to do that root and branch to go in and to make sure that these allegations are either refuted, or are there infrastructural things that need to happen? I mean, it's said in a number of places that the Waterford Fine Gael structure is kind of non-existent. So that allows people to be a bit free-ranging, and that, of course, leads to people stepping on toes, annoying people. And in this case, I think this has got to a very serious head. So I think there's a history to it, but now is Fine Gael head office's job is to go in here and see what's the problem.
Ian Guider?
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty for Fine Gael here is this will not be the only inquiry going on, because, of course, we have the Maria Bailey internal investigation, which is taking much longer than the original 2 weeks, and is spreading on into different areas, such as where the media got its information. You know, we've seen in other parties, I think Sinn Féin have had to deal with allegations at local level of bullying, and we've seen, you know, what parties, they're not, are they set up to do these type of things? Like, they're set up to govern, they have local things, they don't a lot of them don't have the internal procedures in place. And how do you solve what looks to be a local dispute between somebody who got elected and somebody who didn't?
Colin?
I haven't followed this closely, but because we have multi-member constituencies in Ireland, I'm sure Nora Allen has plenty of stories some of which you might be prepared to share. You get this rivalry locally between candidates in the same political party, and it's happened in all of them. It's happened in Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour, Sinn Féin, and so on. But I haven't followed the
John Deasy would agree with you. He basically said, Nora, that this comes down to the fact that some people win seats and some people don't, and then bad blood gets created.
A political party is open for anybody to join. You know, it's not like if you want to join the GAA as a player, you have to be able to play football. But in political terms, if somebody comes to your door and says, I'd like to join your party, you take them in. And then for years and years, the party structures of all the parties ran on common and branch structures, and that was great. And there were decent people who were in those branches and common and whatever, and they were willing to go out and canvass without a candidate. They just went out and canvassed. But in the last 10 years, at least, each candidate now has their own team.
So it's factionalism.
And each has their own team. And sometimes they'll have two or three branch members, but they'll also have their cousins and their uncles and their aunties and everybody. So they're very personalised. And in fact, there's very little canvassing done, I believe, by most parties, unless they have the candidate with them. So this leads to a much more factional thing. So one candidate loses and the other candidate wins. The people around the winning candidate don't particularly like the people around the losing candidate, and vice versa, and it leads to a certain amount of tension, what you did. One of the things that I find that Leo will have to look at is we got rid of the dual mandate for MEP couldn't be a TD. We got rid of the dual mandate that a councillor couldn't be a councillor and a TD, which I was for several years. appoint, this is the first time somebody like John Deasy, and indeed Darragh Murphy in Cork was appointed to the EU, was appointed to a job really, as opposed to just now and again going and doing something, you know. And so John Deasy's in the dilemma that he's appointed as an envoy to the States, and you can see why he can't be at every meeting of the Residents Association, or where there's a hot pothole, or where there's an actual constituency meeting.
He spent 5 minutes, was the claim, at one meeting about the hospital down there, which was a huge issue for people locally. Yeah.
But he was given this job, and so giving somebody a job away offshore was a dilemma for John Deasy as well. Now, Austin, I served for a long time with Austin, and there was, I think, always a certain amount of tension between the candidates at that stage. And there was always tension. I stood with John Boland and I stood with other people. And there's always a bit of tension there. This seems to have built up because Paddy Coffey's brother put the motion down, and therefore that looks as if it's a very, very direct kind of hit at John Deasy. And I think John...
And Paddy Coffey, for his part, has completely rejected all the allegations of any kind of bullying.
But John Deasy seems to be saying that there's been tensions there for years, you know, and a lot of the branch members who are in political parties and common members are all of an older age. I mean, they're not available to climb ladders to put up posters and things anymore. You know, all those kind of jobs that were done loyally and faithfully and with love and care for their party
is
no longer being done now.
Is it unusual for a local organisation to vote no confidence in one of their sitting
PDs? I think that's unusual. That's the bit that I find that the party will have to look at. But look, there's inquiries going on in all parties all the time, because people are always complaining, saying, like, even I was helping with the local elections, and you know, you give a strategy and you're not allowed to go into that area until the last day or the second week or so, and then somebody breaks the rule and they go in and deliver, and there's no sanction really. You call them in and say you shouldn't have had that leaflet delivered, but once it's delivered, it's delivered, and it's hard to assess whether it has won them extra votes or lost votes for somebody. So the nature of politics, so I wouldn't over-egg this particular story, but at the same time, in Waterford, there does seem to be a kind of really endemic, and there haven't been constituency meetings.
Yeah, well, not just in Waterford. As the Mail points out, there seems to be problems.
There were a few other stories,
and
I know
one
or two of the other people who have left the party, but there's always people leaving the party, and there are a lot of people leave the party for reasons because they think I've a better chance of getting elected as an independent or in some other party. And that has happened. You only have to look at across the people who got elected this time to the council. Many of them are what you call family members of other parties, and they have left and got elected then as an independent when they mightn't have got elected in the party. So it's the cut and thrust. But I think this story has kind of highlighted stuff that I think the party has to do. We have an executive council, and what happens when a complaint comes in like this, they set up a subcommittee to actually investigate it, and they call people in and they take interviews, and it can go on a long time, you know, because you've got to get people out of work to come in and talk to you and all that sort of thing. So it'll verge away. I don't know whether John Deasy is even going to stand. He hasn't even said whether he's going to stand or not. He didn't go for the convention.
Well,
so
because he had a back issue.
Yeah. But he didn't. If he had told people that, there might be less tension. I gather people didn't know he had a hip problem and he was having an operation. Right. And probably for himself, he should have said, look, I have a health issue. I can't be at these meetings, so please don't be given out to me.
That point you make, Nora, about, you know, he was elected locally, but it's got a national job. I mean, that is what we should be doing with TDs. They shouldn't be off in their constituency attending every little local meeting about potholes or whatever, electing people to do, and a really important job that John Deasy is doing. And you wonder, will that put off other TDs who might fancy, well, I don't just want to go along to the local residents association meeting, I want to have a wider role in legislation. And as Colin made the point out, where were the TDs scrutinising the national broadband plan? If we elect people to look at national or even international issues, they shouldn't have to worry about what's going on.
Well, maybe here, Ian, I have a go at the media, in the sense that for years the committees that were doing that kind of work, the media just weren't interested in coming to the committees. They are now covering the committee meetings now. And so that's giving, whereas early on when the committee started, you said, if I spend 3 hours at the committee, I'd be better off shouting in the Dáil, having a go at somebody, because I'll get a bit of coverage. And that was the problem. The local papers really covered the local TDs having a go at the government.
And I imagine
and
when you have
the poor, unfortunate front bench spokespeople sat there trying to do real work, and you never got a line.
I imagine as well, when you have John Halligan delivering bring airports and God knows what else down to Waterford, that the pressure must be on for everyone down there to start delivering. In terms of the greater work he's doing out on the bigger picture, Suzanne, do you think the visas will be passed eventually?
Well, I mean, we've still got this problem of the one senator, Tom Cotton, as I mentioned, and he's still holding out, so he's the man to watch. It has been, because Congress finished in January, the midterm elections, so they had to kind of start again, if you like, with the new Congress, and it's gone again to the House, it's been put to the House, but, you know, there's not that much of a difference in terms of the makeup of the House and the Senate, but there's a real irony here, because under Donald Trump, yes, he's anti-immigration, but this is why it's so difficult for the government, because for years the debate has been, well, should we get a special deal with the Irish, or should we be loyal to all the 10 million Hispanics who are undocumented? So what we're trying to do here is get this our own deal for the Irish, let's be honest. But the Australians got it, and, you know, loads of other countries get their own deals, that's the reality. So in one sense, I think the government is trying to kind of keep it under the radar at the same time as trying to publicise it. It's kind of a tricky balance. And ironically, under Trump, I mean, this is the reality, and I just to say it, because we are European, you know, white, you know, you know, and it's probably more of a chance that the Democrats, if they were in power, might be more on the line of, well, what about all the Hispanic votes, you know, that vote for us, in fact, the Democrats. So there's an irony that actually they may have a very good chance under Donald Trump to get this through, or their best chance. And John Deasy, as he points out in his article in the Sunday Independent, worked on the Republican side when he worked in Congress back in the day. So that's why he's arguing he's the person who can make those contacts.
And John Deasy says that his next project, when he moves on from that then, is to look at the undocumented.
Well, that's the other issue, because this was difficult, and I saw this happening. It's very, again, you're talking about internal conflict. It's the same in America among the Irish community. So the people representing the undocumented were kind of a bit put out at the beginning, I think, when John Deasy was appointed, because he said that the numbers of undocumented was much lower. And that's been a debate. But actually, and this is it's a good achievement by the government of John Deasy, that I think they've been brought around, if you like, that the government of John Deasy are trying to say, look, we're going to try and get these new visas, and then once we have them, we will try and get something for the undocumented. We have to work together on this, that they feel. So, I mean, that's something to watch.
But if he doesn't
and
stand
maybe he
for
should
the
try
Dáil,
and get, maybe he should try and get something for Waterford then.
Yes, but if he doesn't stand for the Dáil, you know, the question is, will the next government appoint a special envoy like that? I don't know what the our foreign affairs legislation allows, because he's obviously doing a job there, getting experience of working with the various congressmen and senators, and if he doesn't stand for the Dáil, then that's the end of his.
And can he continue with the network of contacts he's built up?
And can a government appoint somebody, pay them to be an envoy, that they're not part of foreign affairs? Foreign ambassadors were never appointed. In some countries, they're appointed. Just you could be an ambassador, Brendan, but you didn't have to work in the Department of Foreign Affairs.
And the Irish Embassy is doing a lot of work on this as well.
Yes,
Washington,
they are.
Dan McHall, the ambassador,
right,
and the team there. So they're very involved in this too.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Colm McCarthy, Suzanne Lynch, Gráinne Healy, Nora Owen and Ian Guider. Back to the beef thing. A texter says, Donal in Mead, I think what you're not understanding is beef is already being sold at a loss to farmers, by farmers, I presume that means, but not to processors and retailers. Okay, so the farmers are making a loss. Processors and retailers are doing fine. This deal gives more power to the retailers and processors and means Irish beef will be a loss-making business. Only last week, Irish farmers were told we need to change many things to adhere to climate change rules. In Brazil, they're wiping out the Amazon to produce beef. And this is the case,
very
isn't
good
it?
Point. That's one of the strongest points,
we have
points,
a Trump-style figure running
in
things
Brazil,
down in Brazil.
Yeah, and I think that's a real black mark that the EU, obviously there's environmental issues with Brazil, and then, you know, encouraging meat to be sent over from another continent into Europe.
And where that meat is coming from is they are chopping down vast tracts of rainforest. Yeah. I see the size of Cork went last year for beef farmers?
Yeah, very right-wing leader in Brazil. So it's very hard to turn to the farmers in Ireland and say you have to reduce emissions when actually this deal that's been signed on trade with South America opens up questions about the commitment
but
to
I think the quality...
Just Gráinne first,
I think the quality, and this is back to... you know, what is the future for the Irish beef industry? Yeah. And I think it's the quality of the lack of product. Hormones. Yeah. We're going for the higher end.
And we are already selling a premium product,
exactly.
aren't we?
Exactly. And I think that's
the bar. Hard, though. Like in the United States, Ireland has started selling in some beef. But when you go into even the high-end stores like Whole Foods, I always, you know, keep my eye out for it. And Ireland's got grass-fed beef. And it's there without, like, Australia, I think. But it's very, very hard to get in at those margins. Like, that's a high-end supermarket. But, you know, that's the problem. It's a slippery slope. How many people really do want to pay the extra money for the... So that's why...
I wonder if that's not the direction we're moving in, that people are going to eat less beef, but they'll want to eat a good, high-quality...
Well, other areas of America, I can tell you, they're not worried about their...
Suzanne raises, where she says, you know, we're going to be importing, bringing in 99,000 tonnes. I don't know how many ships or planes. That's not a lot of meat. 99,000 tonnes compared to what we're selling isn't a huge amount. But equally, if the deal allows for us to export into these four countries, that's going to be a climate issue as well, because you're going to have to fly your milk powder or your pharmaceutical products or whatever it is. So it's a give and take. So you can't be kind of po-faced about, it's going to bring more damage to the climate, because we're
although
going
the
to
the rainforest issue with Brazil, I
rainforest is a bigger issue.
I think that the chap who tweeted in or texted in from Meath has a fair point, that the beef industry has problems, and it's had problems for many years, and margins for producers of suckler beef have never been terribly good. Dairying has tended to produce better margins on average down the years. The point I was trying to make earlier, though, is one, this deal with Mercosur is not signed, sealed and delivered. There will be conditionality in the years ahead, and it was made quite explicit during the week by Malmstrom, who's the commissioner, that there may be conditionality to do with Brazil's compliance with various climate change objectives. There's a deeper issue here, and it's this. Eventually, we're going to have to consider whether there should be production-based limits on beef in Ireland and various other places. And people have already been talking about, oh, maybe we'll have to cull the herd and all this kind of stuff. You could, though, say, look, we will have indirect taxes on beef consumption. And Irish farmers are kind of afraid of that. Any of them I've ever spoken to are a bit afraid of that. But that could work out okay for us, because we are a low-carbon producer of livestock products in Ireland, right? And Ireland is a carbon-efficient producer of these things. And if you've ever wandered around southeastern Europe, as I have, and you watch herds of six trying to graze the rocky side of a flipping mountain in competition with lizards and things like that, then you begin to wonder what on what on earth are they doing with the livestock industry down there? So maybe the shape that European policy takes the next few years, where there will be carbon taxes, including on food products, that might work out better.
And we have experience of that.
It might work out better for Ireland than a lot of people think.
We've had experience of that, because there's been set aside, you know, and land that was being planted is no longer planted, and farmers were paid, as it were, not to plant. And so you drive around the country and you see big swaths of land, and you say, gosh, I wonder why they're not growing more wheat or whatever it is, and they're not. So there's an experience that at EU level, in order to make sure that there were not overexposure and overproduction, people were doing set aside, and maybe that would
and
come
and it's
too.
Always been a huge part of our brand of our foodstuffs internationally, the whole clean and green
clean
thing
and
everything.
Green and grass,
Gráinne, you were looking at, there's a lot of great pictures and very joyful coverage overall of it's the culmination of Pride Month in Dublin this weekend, Pride Weekend. What would you pick out from there?
Yeah, a lot of coverage across all of the papers, some lovely photographs, great fun, great joy. I mean, I suppose for me, on the march yesterday, I mean, the very first Pride March in Dublin was in 1983, following the murder of Declan Flynn. 200 people turned out for it, a very sad, solemn occasion, and a defiant show of visibility. There were 70,000 people on the march yesterday. And I have to say, having been on many over the last couple of decades, there were six deep all the way down O'Connell Street, down City Quay, right up to Mary. I have never seen, some of them now were tourists, I could see that. But they all had flags and hats and there was great cheering and clapping. So as a celebration of visibility, Ireland has come a great distance. Yesterday was significant for a number of reasons. It was the first time that the Gardaí and the PSNI marched in their uniforms. Now, there were some people critical of this because the original Stonewall incident that occurred in the States was about the police beating up people in an LGBT nightclub. So there's that sense of, have the police always been our friends? But I have to say, I was very proud to see the pride stickers on all of the police cars that were there. The commissioner was there, our prime minister was there. So there's something about acknowledging that on the one hand we've become mainstream, on the other hand the level of commercialism, I was a bit concerned that there were people who were trying to just get onto the march as you used to do. You go up to the Garden Remembrance and you slip in behind whatever banner suits your fancy. The first one I saw yesterday, which was their first time marching, was the civil service LGBT. So this is civil servants for the very first time marching behind a civil servants LGBT banner. So I was thinking there were probably civil servants along the way who would think, I'll just hop in behind that now. I may not be a card-carrying member of it, but that's my tribe.
And is it? That's a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's a great thing. But what I discovered is that because of all of the corporate, so Tesco and Dell and whoever, and they all had big buses and it was amazing. But unless you had a little wristband that you'd gotten previously, you weren't allowed in to actually start at the beginning of the march. And I went to a number of the marches and I said, how do you get into the march if you haven't got a wristband? And they said, oh, when it finishes, everybody else can get in and walk behind the march. So I was just a bit concerned that, and I know it was maybe part of...
These are the problems of success,
It is. It is a problem of success. There's no doubt about
that. And security.
And security, exactly.
You mentioned Stonewall there. I was writing this weekend, it's the 50th anniversary of that in New York, and there's a lot going on in New York, the embassy there. Catherine Zamboni, I think, is marching today and she's getting an award on behalf of Ireland. Yeah. So that was the event you mentioned there where the police raided this place in Manhattan and, you know, the people in that bar fought back essentially, and over five nights there were riots in New York, and it completely changed the history of gay rights, and it was a huge moment. So there's a lot of stuff in the United States marking that this weekend, documentaries, exhibitions. It's a huge thing in the United States, as I say, this weekend.
Okay, and now it's just coming up to 12 noon, so let's go over to the newsroom and Susan Jackson. Thanks, Susan. There's another really interesting text here from a former butcher, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, he was in a mid-range restaurant on Thursday night, and the menu included an 8-ounce sirloin, right? Now, it was a 24-euro set menu, obviously. There was a 5-euro supplement if you wanted to have the 8-ounce sirloin. This would retail presently for €3.50. So he says the farmer probably got about 120. Yeah. I rest my case. I know for a fact that many restaurants are already serving Australian beef. And I think he's got a good point there. David in Castle Knock saying the Irish undocumented deserve no preferential treatment. If they overstayed their visa or entered illegally, they should not be protected by the Irish government. Rules are rules. Do you agree, Nora? Yeah. You were on mic there. Do you agree?
No, I mean, there are a lot of people who have gone through a lot of trouble to get the visas apply and go properly. And at times you do hear them complaining, well, you know, why didn't they do the system right? It took me a year or 2 years or whatever their argument is. And they say, well, why should they get all the notice when we did the right thing? But I think one of the things that John Deasy was right about, I think there was this figure of 60,000 to start with. And then...
And they actually did some research.
They did some real research and people were being double and treble counted because they were going to different centres. You know, there's lots of centres set up. They were registering and they were being set up. I think the figure's probably closer to 10,000. Mm-hmm. And it's not a nice thing because people are married and living there with children.
People are afraid to come home for funerals
or anything like that.
All of it,
but nonetheless...
And living looking over your shoulder.
nonetheless, there's like something that. Kind of we're very good for helping with old development aid and all sorts of things, and yet we want a special deal done for the Irish.
But it was the same with, say, the Cubans who came in legally, or the South Americans.
Yes,
there some of them are very resistant to letting everybody else in.
They put up the ladder behind them.
Very much. And Trump. Oh, we'll get into this a bit, maybe a bit later. But down in Florida this weekend, there was a whole advertisement in the Miami Herald of Trump saying Trump for Latinos, and one line it said something like, you know, tough on immigration, you know, you guys came in the proper way.
Yes.
We're not, and this was aimed at Latinos, you know, we're not going to let everybody else in. And and so there is always that tension between the ones that are already there and it is the proper way, and, you know, how welcoming are they for the others coming in behind them?
Yes.
Okay, and from Trump, we have to talk about Boris, obviously. It's become a weekly Boris watch now. So I'm joined now by Andrew Gilligan, senior correspondent with the Sunday Times. And Andrew has covered Boris in his role as a journalist, obviously, but he's also worked with Boris on and off over the years. Andrew, good afternoon.
Afternoon, how are you?
Good. And do you think Boris is getting a bit of a hard time in terms of coverage, do you?
No, I'm not sure I'd say that. I don't think that some of the things that are said about him, that he is like the British Trump, that he's a racist, that he's a, you know, he's a kind of habitual liar. I don't think those are fair. I think the criticisms of him, I don't deny he deserves criticism in all sorts of ways, but the criticism of him is a bit subtler than that, I think. And I don't think those kind of almost cartoony criticisms land, because people see they're not really right, and I think there's a thing called Boris derangement syndrome. You had Trump derangement syndrome in the US. People hate him so much that they start going over the top. They start calling him a fascist, a Nazi, and things like that. You have a bit of that with Boris as well. People hate him so much that they lose sight. You know, they kind of lose proportion in the criticisms they make of him.
Andrew, to lay out your credentials here. How well do you know Boris, and tell us your various interactions with him down the years?
I mean, I know him a bit. I wouldn't describe myself as all that close to him. I've known him for about 20 years, first as a journalist. Obviously, he was a colleague of mine at the Telegraph when I worked there. And then I wrote for him at The Spectator for a bit, when he was editor of The Spectator magazine. And then for 3 years, 2013 to 2016, I worked for him at City Hall when he was Mayor of London, as his cycling commissioner. So, you know, we built some cycle lanes and things in London.
And did you build a shed as well, or demolish a shed with him?
That's right. I went in. This is about 10 years ago. I went into the to his office at City Hall just for a kind of routine journalistic interview, and he'd just been rung up by the Daily Mirror. He just moved into a new house in Islington, and it hadn't got a study, because all the bedrooms had been converted to bathrooms. The previous owners were Americans, they were obsessed with hygiene, so they converted all the bedrooms to bathrooms. And he decided to build a shed for a study on a flat roof, a sort of first floor flat roof that he had. And unfortunately, he failed to get planning permission. Which
he built
a
shed on a roof.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a problem because he was in charge of the London planning system at the time. So anyway, the local council, which is Labour controlled, grassed him to the Daily Mirror, which then just literally, as I walked through the door, more or less at City Hall, just rung him up and said they were going to do a story about it the next day. So he was in a complete panic, and he just kind of seized on the first sort of remotely friendly face he knew, which turned out to be me, to try and enlisted me to try and help demolish this thing before the paper came out the next day, and before the kind of media circus ensued and anybody else was able to get pictures of the thing. So anyway, so we went back to his house, we spent a couple of hours crawling around on the roof trying to demolish the shed before realizing we were both completely incompetent at any kind of practical task, and also in quite serious danger of falling to our death. So kind of not totally unlike British politics now, you might say, but he is, I mean, I think he did eventually get somebody in. He got like a professional workman in to do it, but we didn't have much success demolishing the shed, let me tell you.
So in general then, how would you describe Boris?
There was a division, there's an old history book called 1066 and all that, which divided people into roundheads, who were right but revolting, and cavaliers, who were, you know, romantic but wrong. And Boris is definitely more of a cavalier than a roundhead. And he appeals to a lot of people all over the place including in Ireland, actually. I mean, my family's Irish, and I know lots of people in Ireland, and I've got an Irish passport, as it happens. But it appears to lots of people in Ireland and in Britain who don't like the kind of sort of political correctness is a boring word, but it sort of sums up that kind of that kind of attitude that kind of priggishness. Mm-hmm. It appeals to a lot of people like that. Now, whether that qualifies him to be Prime Minister, that's much more debatable. But I do think that the politics, not just in Britain, but politics in lots of places, is broken politics as usual. And Boris would be a huge gamble. It could go spectacularly wrong, but it could also go very right. And the alternative, Jeremy Hunt, strikes me as just the kind of embodiment of politics as usual, which has failed pretty comprehensively.
So you would say
with nothing
left to lose, essentially, that people would take a chance on Boris because he seems to have a bit of energy about him and a bit of crack kind of thing.
There's plenty to lose, obviously, but I do think that, in a funny way, Jeremy Hunt's almost as risky as Boris, because he's the risk that we carry on a bit like Theresa May did, sort of conventional politics and trying to do all the right things and actually not managing it. And there's a real impatience in Britain, a real impatience in lots of countries with that way of working. You know, the reason people voted to leave the EU was not really because of the EU. It's because they felt that conventional politics and economics was not working for them. And the referendum gave them a means to express that. They felt excluded from the conventional political system. They felt outside the conversation. They felt their views were not allowed to be heard. And they felt economically disadvantaged as well. And lots of, you know, the Brexit referendum was won by lots of people in small towns and places that, you know, the media never went
so
to.
So, Andrew, you could be describing how the election of Donald Trump and the Trump base is described.
Yeah, but I indeed could, and I think the forces which have produced them are similar, but they are not similar characters. To give you, I mean, anyone who knows what Boris was like as Mayor of London would know that the parallels with Trump just don't work. Boris was basically a liberal centrist as Mayor of London, and you know, the one time he's had real power, he did all sorts of things which were firmly in the centre. He raised the London living wage. He spent lots of money on public services. He funded medical help for refugees. He took out space. This is what I was involved with. He took out road space from cars for cyclists and buses, something which absolutely infuriated his right-wing base. And he was staunch about all that. So the idea that he's a Trump politically is wrong. But he does benefit from some of the same forces.
What were his weaknesses that you saw when you worked with him?
Well, one of the common weaknesses that people say about him is he doesn't do detail. And that's true. I mean, he's perfectly capable of doing detail. He could do it whenever he wanted and needed to. Like the one occasion he had to present something in detail himself to a big meeting that I couldn't do on the cycling side, he was brilliant at it. We gave him a 30-minute briefing the night before and he was pitch perfect. But mostly he didn't want to do detail. And actually, I always thought that was a strength, not a weakness, because I think a leader's role is not to get themselves immersed in the detail. The leader's role is to set out the general direction and tone, to choose the right people, and then to inspire them to implement it. And Boris is really good at that. And you know, we've had a couple of prime ministers, two out of our last three prime ministers, really now, Gordon Brown and Theresa May, have been ferocious detail people and deeply, deeply unsuccessful prime ministers. Probably the second and third, and their first and second most unsuccessful prime ministers we've ever had. So detail alone doesn't get you there. So I don't think the criticism that he lacks interest in detail is a valid one.
You were at the hustings yesterday, Andrew, were you? Just one second, Nora.
Yes, I was, yeah. I was at Carlisle in Manchester.
Yeah, and you were talking to Boris yesterday.
He came over. I was writing my piece afterwards, and it was a Carlisle racecourse, and the press bit was in one of the boxes in the stands, and then there were like private rooms for the candidates a little bit further down. And I was sitting outside on the balcony, and he saw me. writing on the balcony and came over and kind of looked over my shoulder, tried to rewrite the intro, actually. He was on reasonably good form in Carlisle. He was, you know, kind of full of gags. I mean, I did come across several people who said that that they like him as a person, but they didn't see him as a prime minister. And Jeremy Hunt was just more prime ministerial.
Is he having a problem as well in trying to present himself as a serious person? He sometimes looks... I was looking at him this morning on Sky News. When he's trying to do the serious stuff, he looks as if the air has been sucked out of him and he's not the kind of Boris that people, to use the term, know and love. Is there an element of that?
I think that's right. I think that's a very accurate thing to say. I think the he can do serious. One of the most interesting things about his mayoralty of London, again, you heard the same people saying the same things before he became mayor, that it was going to be a disaster. He couldn't handle anything serious. London would fall apart. It didn't happen. One of the most interesting things about his mayoralty was this kind of boring competence at its central tasks. All sorts of things which are going up now, like council tax and crime and air pollution and traffic congestion, they went down under Boris. And all sorts of things which are going down now, like you know, bus usage, capital investment, number of houses being built, they went up under Boris. He was actually extremely competent at the central task. He was hard about getting the right team around him, but it wasn't just the team. It was the it was the way he managed to set the direction and inspire them.
Andrew, do you think he should have answered questions about his private life in the last week?
I do, actually, and I think he hates talking about it, and he I still don't quite know the whole story. I think it would have been a lot simpler if maybe he or Carrie had just made a brief statement. Didn't have to be a kind of great TV interview or anything like that. Just a brief on the record statement saying this was a marital or a lover's argument of the kind that happens in lots of partnerships, and we were grasped on by these politically motivated neighbours, and that's the end of it. And
I think same politically motivated neighbours who made him take down that shed on his roof.
That was a different lot of neighbours.
It's the same kind of thing, isn't it, Andrew? Those guardian reading neighbours, we all have them.
Well, you know, he and Carrie, their flat's in Camberwell, which is a kind of quite middle-class part of London now. It used to be quite rough. It's been really gentrified now, and it's full of the kind of people who really hate his guts. two of them called the police, which I think is fair enough, if they were worried about somebody's safety. The police then came and told them, these neighbours, that there was nothing to worry about. They then tipped off the Guardian, which I think is a slightly dodgy bit. And I think so Boris is within his rights to be cross with them, as I think he was. But I think he could have shut the whole thing down a bit quicker and made it just a bit simpler. If you know, he or Carrie, preferably both of them, just issued a statement saying, look, this is what happened. It's been blown out of proportion. Can you respect our privacy? They didn't do that. And as a result, the story rumbled on longer than it should have done. Maybe that's because, I don't know this, this is pure speculation on my part, maybe that's because she didn't want to. I don't know.
Okay, Andrew, I want to bring in Nora Owen, who's a former Minister for Justice.
Good afternoon, Andrew. Andrew, listening to what you're saying about Boris and the kind of things that people seem to like about him, I have to say, he's not running for a place on Big Brother or Love Island or anything. He's running to be the Prime Minister of a country that is in really dire difficulties. And I just wonder what you would say to people who say, look, one day he says one thing, the next another. I mean, the airport issue, his stance on Turkey joining the EU and then withdrawing it. Everything he says, he can quite glibly just discard. And so essentially what you're getting is a blank sheet. And maybe is what he's aiming for, so that people can't say you can't do a deal with Brexit because you've already said this or that or the other. I mean, are these not issues that the Conservative members who are voting are concerned about?
Andrew?
Well, bluntly, I think that's part of his attraction. You're right. I mean, one of the fascinating things about him is that who knows what he truly believes. I do think, as I said in the piece I wrote for the paper a couple of weeks ago, that his kind of factory setting is one nation Toryism. and he was a notably centrist and liberal mayor of London. But at the same time, he said some things which are against that, clearly. But interestingly, that is perhaps part of his appeal, because he is a slightly blank space politically, but in policy terms, that people can project on him what they want, what they want for themselves. So that is why he is able to have the support of both Marc Francois, who's the ultimate hard Brexiteer, the ultimate crash out without a deal Brexiteer, and Damien Green and Damien.
But Andrew, he's got to be lying to somebody, isn't he?
Well, interestingly, firstly, in terms of saying different things at different times, they all do that. Obviously, Jeremy Hunt was a Remainer, and he's now firmly committed to a hard Brexit if necessary. I mean, that's not much more credible than Johnson's position, to be honest. They're all the same on that. The appeal of Johnson is he is such a kind of two-faced opportunist, if you like, that he might find, that this is what a lot of the Remainers who are backing him think, he's such a two-faced opportunist that he might find some way to sort of wheedle us through this terrible mess that we're in. He might find some way to sell what is basically a version of Theresa May's deal with knobs on. He might find some way to sell that to the hard Brexiteers.
Okay, Andrew, I want to bring in Ian Guider.
Yeah, Andrew, I was listening to Boris give the interview with Talk Radio, where he said he would leave on October 31st, come what may, do or die. Given that he is the personality that flip-flops and has no fixed position, why are the real Eurosceptics you mentioned Marc Francois and Jacob Rees-Mogg, why do they trust him to actually leave on October the 31st?
Well, you'd have to ask them.
But you see, that's the question. Do the ERG actually trust Boris anymore? No, I get an inkling they don't, do they?
But I think they probably trust him more than the alternative. They probably trust him more than they trust Jeremy Hunt. That's what we're down to. We're down to choices between alternatives. I think some of them would have preferred Dominic Raab, who's the ultimate hard Brexiteer, as their Prime Minister, but he crashed out pretty early in the voting. It's absolutely clear that Boris is going to end up disappointing some of his supporters. There's no way he can keep that kind of broad coalition happy. But the hope of people, I mean, lots and lots of Remainers support Boris. George Osborne, Damien Green, Damien Collins, lots and lots of people who voted Remain. And their hope is that he can somehow wangle it so that he'll come back with something which he can sell to the hard Brexiteers. And I think that is a possible outcome. I don't actually think the EU wants a no-deal Brexit. They blinked in April, they blinked in March. I think it would be very damaging to them. It would be hugely damaging to Ireland, of course, which is an EU member. And they care about Ireland much more than they care about us, I'm sure. They don't want a no-deal Brexit for those reasons. And they also don't particularly want, I don't imagine, a kind of permanently alienated large country off their northwestern coast.
This is fundamentally what's going on here. The gamble is that you think that if Boris brazens this out, that Europe will blink, that Ireland will not get the support, and that Boris will win in the end.
I think one of the main reasons Europe will blink is they don't want Ireland to suffer the fate of a no deal. Because I think
I know it's going to be very damaging to Ireland, Andrew, but are ye deluded over there about what a no deal Brexit is going to do to the UK?
Oh, no, I'm not. Obviously, it'll be hugely damaging to us, but I think it might be just as damaging to Ireland, maybe even more damaging.
Colin, as an economist?
Andrew, at the very beginning of your remarks, you made the point quite reasonably that Johnson has been unfairly painted as a fascist and all this kind of stuff. But the rest of your remarks really amounted to saying he's not a fascist, but he's a chancellor, and that this is a qualification to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And that's kind of sad. And it's sad in particular when on all the credible analyses that have been done, the no-deal crash-out that Boris is happy to court will do enormous damage to the United Kingdom. One of the reasons why people in Ireland are bothered about a no-deal crash-out is precisely because it will do a lot of damage to the United Kingdom. Nobody here wants to see the UK economy weakened. Why on earth would we? You've made a case for Boris Johnson. Perhaps you didn't mean to make a case for him, that amounts to saying, trust this guy because he's a chancellor.
I don't think it's quite what I was saying. But I think the.
But you are in fairness saying trust this guy because we don't know what we're going to get. Trust Boris because he might not be the Boris we think he is.
I'm not saying trust him because he's a chancer.
Aren't you? Let's try Boris because we're not sure what we'll get and we might not get what we expect from Boris. Is that roughly the line of thinking?
What I'm saying here is that part of Boris's appeal to the wide spectrum of opinion is that
he's an empty vessel.
Empty vesselness in policy.
Okay.
Allows people to project onto him, allows people of widely varying views to project onto him what they want to see. And I think it is possible, and as I say, I've always thought, I don't believe that we will end up with a no deal. I don't believe that actually he or Hunt or anyone else wants a no deal. I don't believe the EU wants a no deal. I think they probably will come back with some kind of superficial twiddle to Theresa May's deal. This is my central case, that they'll come back with some kind of superficial twiddle.
Despite the fact that they have made it clear all the time, Andrew, are you hearing this, that they continue to make it clear that that is not going to happen?
I think you've heard different signals, actually. I think you've heard different signals from the likes of Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, who is the new leader of the CDU. You've seen different signals from other places in Brussels. The signals have not been consistent.
I suppose it depends on what you're choosing to hear.
I don't think they will change the deal dramatically. I think they will change the deal just enough to enable Johnson to sell it as some great triumph and you know, we'll see whether the Eurosceptics will go for that.
God, I hope you're not relying on a lot of what-ifs there, Andrew. Grainne Healy wants to come in.
Yeah, I think Andrew's own story about the story of the shed on the roof, I mean, I'm horrified that this guy who may be the Prime Minister, you know, was building a shed illegally. It's unsafe, and he was only taking it down in case the media got hold of the story. So in Andrew's own words, you know, this guy is a huge gamble. But this is not just about, you know, somebody who's going to run the local shop. This will be the guy who will be leading, Britain and in a scary way. But I think one of the key worries I have is it's not so much that he flip-flops on things, it's that he's actually quite a fantasist. And in this way, while I know you were trying to make a big difference between himself and Trump, there is an element of the fantasist Boris that is quite scary. So, for example, in terms of what he has promised to do around the Irish border, in his view, there'll be a technological approach that will mean customs and regulations will take place automatically. Everybody who is anyone on this is saying that technology is years away from...
I want to let Andrew answer that. Andrew, is that a bit unfair to suggest that he's a fantasist?
I don't think it's completely fair. I think that I don't underestimate the difficulties that the UK finds itself in and the difficulties that Ireland finds itself in through no fault of its own as a result of the UK's decisions. But I don't believe that the gap between what was proposed between Theresa May's deal and what could be accepted by the UK Parliament is all that small. Even Theresa May's deal came quite close at one point to being accepted by the Eurosceptics. Back in March, there was a moment where if Geoffrey Cox, the British Attorney General's advice, had gone the other way, she would have got her deal through. I think.
Would she, Andrew? Is the backstop not only the beginning of the problems with that deal? That once, if the backstop was fixed, there would still be huge problems with the deal for a lot of Tories, wouldn't there?
The deal is only a withdrawal agreement. The future relationship still has to be negotiated. But all I'm saying is that it is not. We were not all that far away from getting Theresa May's deal passed. Already, even with Theresa May, the worst saleswoman in British prime ministerial history, in charge of selling it, with a better salesperson and some tweaks, I think it could go through. And I think Boris Johnson is potentially that salesperson. And I don't think I'm not saying that, you know, the choices are ideal. I'm not saying that the country's not in a terrible mess. And I'm said right at the beginning, it's a huge gamble. It could go very, very badly wrong. And I hope everyone heard that.
Yeah, sure.
I do think that that we need something more than politics as usual to make this work. And clearly, a lot of other Euro, a lot of other sort of Remainer type people also agree with me. They are backing Boris Johnson.
Okay, Andrew Gilligan, thank you very much, and we'll take a break.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco Club Card, helping you save more every time you shop. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back. Our panel has been very heated with each other. Mostly still here. Colm McCarthy is with us. Gráinne Healy is with us. Ian Guider is with us. And Suzanne Lynch, we'll turn to you now. We've had our Boris update for the week. Trump has been very active even in the last 24 hours. Yeah. He's filled about a year of news. Yeah. Tell us first maybe about what's been going on in North Korea.
Yeah, so this happened overnight in the afternoon, really, in North Korea. Donald Trump has been in Japan for the G20. He went to South Korea for a planned visit, and then he announced, really, on Twitter, he kind of put out an invitation for Kim Jong-un to meet him at the demilitarized zone between North Korea and South Korea. And early this morning, our time, Donald Trump arrived at the border, and there was Kim Jong-un. The two went to meet each other, and Donald Trump became the first sitting US president to step into North Korean territory. So look, this is his third meeting now with the North Korean dictator, and this is classic Trump. It was very much a live televised dramatic moment, and the reports now that some of his officials were warning him not to do this, that this wasn't a good idea, and it looks like North Korea only got a kind of a 24-hour notice period. So in terms of logistics, it was quite a big deal for the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, to come down and do this. They weren't sure if they would.
Which suggests that Kim Jong-un is keen to play, yeah?
But the big problem, of course, is that Donald Trump is negotiating with someone who hasn't made any concessions. I mean, the second summit with North Korea ended without agreement back in February in Vietnam, and North Korea has not made steps to denuclearise. That's the bottom line. In fact, back in May, it launched short-term missiles last month. So the problem is that Donald Trump is engaging with someone who hasn't given away anything, and America's got very little in return for that. So why is he giving him that international stage? I mean, not to be too dramatic, but there is touches of 1938 in this. We all know what was happening in Europe, and Britain, because it was so understandably, did not want to go into war, kept saying, oh, he's fine, Hitler's fine. You know, that's the policy of appeasement. Neville Chamberlain went over, came back with his piece of paper from Munich and said, peace in our time. This guy we can do business with. Donald Trump keeps giving Kim Jong-un the benefit of the doubt just because he's writing the letters, he talks about the personal chemistry. But there are doubts about how authentic mm-hmm. that is.
But when you look at how fractured, look at the G20 and how fractured the world is and everything, is there an argument to be made that it's good to talk to these guys?
Well, it's a gamble. I mean, we don't know. I mean, Kim Jong-un, what's going on in North Korea? There's very little knowledge of what's going on in there. Obviously, massive human rights issues. I'm wondering, and it's just coming out now, was it something to do with China? China is a kind of an ally of North Korea in that region. It's the country that does the only kind of trade with North Korea. And Trump met President Xi at this G20.
And this was positive vis-a-vis trade.
Yeah, it was positive.
President
Xi said they're going to work together, China and America, on the trade deal, because that's been a real worry on the international economy.
Am I misunderstanding? Was that a kind of a stunning turnaround on Huawei when Donald Trump?
So that's an interesting point. So, and this came up during the meeting between Donald Trump and Leo Varadkar before the meeting, that the US has been warning its allies in Europe to not do business about Huawei, the big Chinese company.
Because it is effectively controlled by the Chinese
that
government
it's
spying
that it's
for them and
access.
All that. Yeah.
But he seems to have done a bit of an about turn now this weekend. Now, he didn't lift the sanctions, just to be clear. He just hinted that he might soften it.
So and he said this that he will allow American companies
to do business.
Continue to
or
sell,
he hinted
sell
that he will
into
allow
Huawei.
Them to.
Okay,
but this is an example of Trump's flip-flopping. So America went around the world, essentially, telling other allies, maybe don't do business with Huawei. And then after 5 minutes with President Xi, Donald Trump said, actually, you know what, we're rethinking things. So this is his scattergun approach to diplomacy. But the North Korean issue, we're coming after a week of heightened tensions with Iran. So I think there's a completely contradictory foreign policy at work here. On the one hand, he's talking about doing the deal of the century with North Korea on nuclear arms. And at the same time, he pulled America out of a nuclear deal that was working. that curbed Iran's nuclear activity. So there's no surprise Iran has responded the way it has, and it's under crippling sanctions. US pulled out of the deal, even though Iran was sticking to its side. So on the one hand, when
there was a question over whether Iran was sticking to their side.
No, it was. The international monitors went in there, and Trump's problem was that the deal itself, he feels, was too limited, and it would have allowed them in a few years to start again. But technically, there were. So, you know, how do people do business with America? You know, even if North Korea did sign up to something with America, you know, if Trump is out of power, another president might do something else. So I think these mixed messages coming from Washington are very, very dangerous in terms of foreign policy.
Is it flip-flopping or mixed messages, or is he the ultimate transactional person in which you look at the trade war with China? He sat down the other day, there's a deal on the table. North Korea,
we
fell apart with North Korea back in February, but we can do a deal. Is that the ultimate thing that he wants?
I think you're right on trade. I think trade, it's the one thing that he has been right on, I think, is to challenge China's dominance and its role in kind of stealing intellectual property and the kind of trade imbalances. He's right about that. But North Korea, for a deal maker, he hasn't got anything in return yet. So North Korea hadn't given anything. They've got everything. They've got three meetings with the US president, and the US yet has not got anything. So it's a bit like what we're talking about now. It's a gamble. If, you know, he's taken a chance on this, if it comes along and, they start denuclearising, fine. But there isn't any sense so far that they will do that. And perhaps maybe cleverly for him, they won't before the election. So he'll be able to say, I'm making these interludes and, you know, things are going well without anything actually happening until he's out of office. So
There's a lot of other American stories in your bailiwick this week, and I do want to get on to a few more of them. So obviously, there was that shocking photo this week of Oscar Martinez Ramirez and his 23-year-old daughter drowned crossing the Rio Grande, and her arm around his shoulder. You were down in Homestead in Florida. That is the biggest detention camp.
Yeah, the largest child detention facility for children in the United States. And I went down there during the week. The presidential debate for Democrats was on in Florida, so that's why I was there. But Elizabeth Warren and some of the other candidates took a trip to this child center. Mm-hmm. There's about 2,500 children in there, mostly teenagers. And there it was, I can't even describe the heat. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, it was under the baking hot Florida sun. And you could see the young teenagers behind the wall. Like, nobody can get in there, but you could see them out in the yard. And I think this week, the immigration issue has resurfaced as a huge political issue in the United States. It's a year since the whole controversy over Donald Trump separating children from parents really kind of hit the headlines. Things have been relatively quiet. But this week, a couple of things happened. A facility in Texas, they had to move more than 200 children out of there because lawyers went into this facility and reported appalling conditions. So that put
and
it...
This week, there are toddlers in there being minded by children of 7 or 8 who they don't even know them. Children
no toothbrushes,
basic,
no nappies. Yeah. It was horrific. And one of the issues...
And by the way, I said that Oscar Martinez Ramirez's daughter was 23 months, obviously, I misspoke there.
So one of the issues for coverage is that, you know, media are not allowed into these facilities. So these lawyers in Texas got into that facility down there as part of a court case, and then they reported. Down in Florida, for example, Elizabeth Warren, these guys didn't get in there, but some local Congress people have got in. So
is this changing the game politically in
the
US?
Unfortunately, and this might sound very harsh to people, the Republican Mike Pence came out this week, just I think yesterday, and said that horrific picture actually underlines why we need to build a wall. So both political parties are using this. Democrats are using it to go this, you know, apparent immigration policy that President Trump is practicing. And the Republicans are saying this is why we need to be stricter on immigration and not encourage these people to come into our country. So it is reigniting this issue ahead of the election next year. And Trump knows that this works with his base. Elizabeth Warren, I think said it, and some other people I spoke to down there, protesters, said that Donald Trump uses this as bait. He uses immigrants as bait, you know, and he is going to probably mention that at his rallies because this is one of the reasons he was elected. And Republicans, you know, a certain amount of his supporters want to be tough in immigration, build a border wall. And I think, unfortunately, this underlines their argument in some way.
Grainne.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in this we're often focused on, you know, what are they doing in America? And that was a dreadful, dreadful photograph. And I suppose one hopes when you see those photographs that it will change something, that image of the child last year, you know, dead on the beach. But the truth is that, you know, if we have to look look into our own backyards. I mean, the Italians this week arrested the captain of the ship who was actually saving people from the Mediterranean. You know, there have been more people have died trying to get across the Med to Europe than have died trying to get into the States. So this is a global issue, and I feel that we can be completely in the sort of, it's all about Trump and it's a terrible thing he's doing, but the global migration problem is something that the EU itself is not dealing with and can't be having the high moral ground.
But contrast the reaction now to that photograph and the reaction back down when that photograph, that little baby boy washing up, I think it was in Greece or Cyprus. Yeah. Like, that did prompt the European Union to open its doors. It prompted Germany, and I know it's led to a lot of trouble for Angela Merkel, but the reaction now is we're now using immigration as a political battle as opposed to actually dealing with it and showing some sort of compassion at least.
Speaking of the political battle, so you went to the main event really in the Democratic debate. So the first night, it was odd the way they divided it up because Elizabeth Warren ended up being there the first night against a bunch of randomers. So you went the second night.
Yeah, so there's 25 candidates running for the Democratic nomination. 20 of those qualified, so they split it at random. 10 on the first night, 10 on the second. Now, as it happened, more of the heavy hitters were on the second night. So the first night was fairly conventional. The candidates actually had more in common than they had things that divided them. And Elizabeth Warren was the front runner, but very little tension, very little spark. The second night, though, I was down at the event in Miami. And really, the big takeaway there was the Joe Biden performance and Kamala Harris's attack on Biden over race. Now, Joe Biden was always going to be the fulcrum of this. He's still a fair bit ahead of all the others. And
isn't
he announced he was running back in April, and from that point, he's been ahead in virtually all polls among Democrats and among the public at large. And we know that Donald Trump himself is worried because he's been tweeting about him. He's called him Sleepy Joe. And, you know, the officials near close to Trump are saying that this is the man that Donald Trump is most worried about, because the argument of Biden people is that he's the person who can communicate with the disaffected Democrats in the Rust Belt states that voted for Trump after voting Democrat all their life. So this is his selling point.
Biden is the guy, a lot of people think, who could actually be Trump.
Yeah. Now I went,
what the Democrats are supposed to want. They've been obsessed with getting rid of Trump for 3 years now, but in every other way, except when it comes to an election, then they're not putting their best foot forward.
Well, this is the problem. I saw Joe Biden's first event in Pittsburgh last month, and he was quite good, and he engaged with people, and all the supporters I spoke to, you were getting this issue. Look, they're so appalled really by Donald Trump, Democrats. They just want somebody who is going to beat him. So they're prepared to put ideology aside. They might prefer someone more left wing. But that all changed, I think, on Thursday. Joe Biden got up to that stage and he crumpled, really, I think. Kamala Harris, who's a senator from California, not that experienced in national politics, but she was the Attorney General of California for years. Yeah. She got up, took on Joe Biden, and there was a few worrying things. Number one, he didn't seem ready for her criticism. So he had gone into controversy about comments he made about race last week.
Well, he was asked, have you an example of working with people that you completely disagree with on the board, but managing to work with them? And he said he had, and they were segregationists.
Yeah, but they were very hardcore segregationists from the South back in the day. And, you know, the judgment of using that as an example to say, what's your standard? You can work with other people across the aisle, but I think that was a bit misjudged.
But if you're Donald Trump, are you not sitting at home rubbing your hands and watching the Democrats tear each other apart over identity politics, which his base and a lot of other people don't care about?
But you're right. But then the problem for Joe Biden now is that there was a feeling watching this there on Thursday. If he's not able to take on Kamala Harris, how is he going to deal with Donald Trump in those one-to-one debates?
Okay.
So I think the whole electability of Joe Biden issue that seemed to be his calling card began to... Now, he may save this. And, you know, we don't know, as you said, the opinion polls, they might not have changed much after Thursday.
Okay. Colin McCarthy, you're being very quiet on all this. Are we looking at 4 more years of Donald Trump in your economic opinion?
Yeah, 5. I mean, the election is November next year. I sincerely hope not. One of the background features of the whole climate change debate is the absence of a coordinated position between the United States, the European Union and China. And more than half of all the carbon emissions come from those three places. China is about a quarter, the United States about 15 or 16%, and the European Union is 10 or 11. And it has always been the likelihood that if those three, which dominate the world economy, if those three came together and said, look, folks, we've got a serious problem here, we've got to cut emissions, we're going to do it, and we're going to bully everybody else. Those three could bully everybody else. But Donald Trump believes, this is a direct quote, that climate change is a hoax got up by China to damage America. That's what he believes. And we're now in the remarkable position where, of those three key units in the world economy, the European Union has a serious climate policy. I think there's a lot of problems with it, but at least it's serious, and I think it's sincere. China is heading in that direction, and the United States doesn't. It has a climate change denier as president who has massive support.
Okay.
If you are a person that's worried about climate change, and if you're not, you should be, and a kind of a green or environmentalist person, you should be lighting candles that Trump gets beaten next year. If he's in there, these are very important years for all of this. If Trump is there for another 5 years, it's a bad outcome.
Okay, and we'll take a break.